Whoops, my paperclip came out. Oh, there it is. I read this morning from two passages in the Old Testament and one in the New, from two books that are referred to as minor prophets, Habakkuk and Joel. They're called minor prophets not because their teaching was insignificant, but because their writing was brief. In Habakkuk chapter 2, these words. Then the Lord answered me and said, "Write the vision. Make it plain on tablets so that a runner could read it. For there is still a vision for the appointed time. It speaks of the end and does not lie. If it seems to tarry, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay." And the prophet Joel, God says, "I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams, and your young men shall see visions. Even on the male and female slaves, in those days I will pour out my spirit." And then in the New Testament, in the first action of the early church, on the day of Pentecost, a day when these first Christians just boiled out of that upper room and began to talk to the people of Jerusalem about God's Spirit moving within them, people thought they were drunk. And so Peter stands up and says, "We're not drunk. No, this is what was spoken through the prophet Joel. I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams, even upon my slaves, both men and women. In those days I will pour out my spirit." God gives dreams. They may be slow to be fulfilled, but they're God's dreams. We celebrate this weekend the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We remember him mostly because of his death and the dreams that brought about his death. Dr. King, who died at the age of 39, had a dream of a society in which men and women would be judged by the content of their characters rather than the color of their skin. He had a dream in which all people would be held to be equal in the eyes of God and of the law. Dr. King died because he dared to live out that dream. I remember very distinctly my reaction when I heard of Dr. King's assassination. I was, as I told you last week, I was called at the age of 6 to become a minister and grew up never planning to be anything else. Went off to college at a good school, Emory University in Atlanta. I was a sophomore at Emory when word of Dr. King's death came, and you can imagine living in Atlanta how striking that news was. And I remember that my reaction was, "Well, I'm sorry to hear anybody die, but maybe this will quiet things down." You see, I had been led to believe that the greatest good a Christian can do is to be polite and quiet and peaceful and not shake things, not disturb things. Dr. King disturbed things. So now that he's dead, maybe we can return to what a Christian lifestyle should be, which is to be peaceful and not rock the boat. Now, my parents did not raise me to be racist. They would have abhorred racism. But like so many people of their time, they didn't realize that the way society was structured was inherently racist. And that all of us who grew up in a society that was consciously or unconsciously racist would become consciously or not racist. I went through 12 years of public schools and never saw a black student. Not in school, not in the athletic conferences, nowhere. They simply just didn't exist. It wasn't until I was in college that I had a class with someone who was other than white. Dr. King spent time in Birmingham jail for his acts of civil disobedience, standing up for what was right. And he wrote one of the finest religious writings ever written. And I'm sure if we were putting a third testament of the Bible together today, it would be included, as Paul's writings from prison are included. In Letter from Birmingham Jail, he said, "I'm particularly disappointed in the reaction of white moderates." He could understand the overt racism that had thrown him in jail. He said, "What disappoints me are white moderates, Christian leaders, who feel that things should be kept peaceful and quiet and don't rock the boat and don't disturb and don't come in and agitate for change." He says, "That is what hurts." Now, overt racism is not as popular as it used to be. Although, I was standing in the corner here at the Beach Club, the boutique building, this week, and was watching a pickup truck go by with a Confederate flag waving on it. And I'm sure if I'd stopped the driver of the truck and asked, they would say, "Well, that's a symbol that I love the South and I'm a free spirit." But to me, it says, "You believe in the right to own slaves." The less obvious kind of racism is the one we do not know we have. And I will confess to you, and I shared this in a Martin Luther King Day speech that I was privileged to give a few years ago, I'm a racist. I don't want to be. But I cannot fully escape being raised as I was in the society I was in. I would like to think my sons have escaped that, but I have not. What that means is I don't want to be racist, I abhor racism, but I still react differently with certain groups of people than with others. To this day, when I'm driving around the beachside here, if I see black people walking, I do a double take. What are they doing here? Because I know when I moved here, I checked the census. In 32169 zip code, there was one black male over 65 living on the beachside. That was it. That was our diversity. And so to this day, I do a double take. Well, that's racism. I don't want to be a racist, but that's a part of my upbringing. I liken racism to alcoholism. If you understand and admit that you are an alcoholic, you can deal with it and control it. If you understand that your perceptions are, even though you don't want it to be that way, are racist, if you admit that, you can deal with it. If you can't admit it, if you don't see it in yourself, then it will come out. So there is racism throughout our society. I see it all the time. I went to high school in Jacksonville. I graduated in 1966 from Nathan Bedford Forrest Senior High School, which is right the next one down from Robert E. Lee High School. And Bedford Forrest was one of two geniuses, according to Shelby Foote, created by the Civil War, the other being Abraham Lincoln. Bedford Forrest was a brilliant Confederate cavalry general, one of the greatest generals the United States ever produced. Before the war, he was a slave trader in Mississippi, and after the war, he was first Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. So I graduated from Forest High School, the Rebels, our nickname, in 1966. Jacksonville school system changed the name of that school a year ago this month. And as an alumnus, I got emails about it, and the Alumni Association wrote saying, "Communist agitators are lobbying the school board to change the name of our beloved Forest High School." How out of date can you get? Communist agitators? I mean, give me a break. And we're sure you'll want to write the school board and tell them how you feel. Well, I did. 93% of the people who answered that survey asked that the name be kept the same. They surveyed the teachers at the high school. 65% of the teachers wanted to keep the name the same. This is last year. They did change the name to a very boring Westside High School. Racism is a part of who we are in our society. And we can, it seems to be something in human nature that makes us think that my group is better than your group. Who I am is a little bit better than who you are. So let's get together with people just like myself and look down on people who are different. That kind of racism, tribalism, happens in all kinds of people. But it's worst and most noticeable in people who are in power, who have the authority. When I was in college, I was planning to be a minister. That was my calling. I was going to go to seminary when I finished college. I was at Emory University in Atlanta, which is a Methodist school. So I thought, well, you know, I should go. If I'm going to be a minister, I should go to church. So it's not like there are any lack of churches in Atlanta. I mean, at every single intersection in town, there's a brick church. And so I started looking for a church to attend. I looked for 2 years. Every church I went to was boring beyond belief. And I've come to believe that the second greatest sin a church can commit is to be boring. Boring, boring, boring. You understand. So I gave up. Decided it was a lot better to sleep late on the Sunday morning. And then one day, somebody told me about a church that might be different. Trinity United Methodist, downtown, right downtown Atlanta. It'd been there so long that Trinity was on Trinity Street. Predated the Civil War. Across the street from City Hall, a block and a half from the state capitol. The new building was built in 1902. The pews had been used as cots for the wounded during the Battle of Atlanta and the Civil War. Governors of the state had been members of that church. It was the first Methodist church in the state of Georgia to integrate, to minister to people of all kinds, including the Capitol Homes housing project, which bordered our downtown area. So I went down there, and it was January of 1969, a few months after Dr. King's death, and I walked into that church, and my life changed. It changed for two reasons. First of all, I walked in, and there, standing in the hallway, were three young women, Becky and her sister and another friend, and I fell in love instantly. I wasn't sure with which one. Took me a while to sort that out. And I saw in that church a glimpse of what heaven's supposed to be. Sitting on the front row, in that pulpit, this huge, huge, huge sanctuary with maybe 75 people in it. On the front pew there was Dr. Trawick Stubbs, the PhD director of the Georgia Mental Health Institute. Next to him was Bobby Patterson, a 16-year-old African-American boy who lived in the housing project and sold drugs. Next to him was Mrs. Bill. She was 78, she was blind, she was white, she lived in the housing project. Next to her was a blonde high school student from the suburbs of Atlanta whose father owned the second largest construction company in the city. Next to her was a six-year-old girl who later was busted by the city hall police because she was jimmying the parking meters in front of our church. And next to her was Dr. Wayan Sen, a Chinese doctor who was on the faculty at Emory University. Which reminds me, I didn't tell this last service, the church risked a great deal to integrate. We got bomb threats because we'd integrated. And you just couldn't begin to appreciate how much it had cost the church. The minister changed things so that the first thing we did was the worship service and then Sunday school afterwards, because prior to that, while he was waiting for the service to start, people would gather outside his office to complain loudly and left to him to hear for what he'd done to that church in integrating it. So he changed it where the first thing he did was preach and then go on from there. It cost so much to integrate that church. And I'll never forget this little black boy walking up, looking over at Dr. Wayan Sen, this Chinese doctor standing there, and saying to the pastor, "Hey, pastor, what's that Jap doing in our church?" We all have that tendency to look down on people who are different from ourselves. I remember taking a van load of our youth down to Jonesboro, Georgia. The youth director at the church, Methodist Church in Jonesboro, invited us to come down. We had a steel band. Our minister had the great idea he could get jobs for some of these kids in the project. And so we went down to Jamaica and brought back Rupert Henry, who built some steel drums, and got them jobs at Six Flags. And so we had the steel drum band, so we had half the kids were black, and then we had a bunch of white kids in the group. And so we were invited to go down to Jonesboro. I drove the van down there, and I've never been an activist. I've always been quiet. But one time in my life, I got run out of town. Deputy sheriff came up and said, "Y'all need to leave town." What was really sad is the deputy was black. I can't imagine what he was going through. And I can't imagine what happened to the youth director that invited us to that church. But there they were playing in that church, and we got run out of Jonesboro. 1972. That church changed my life. It taught me that to be peaceful and respectable and quiet is not the highest calling for a Christian. It's to take some risks. It's to do things that make people really mad at you. In the interest of a dream. A dream that the kingdom of heaven can be realized right there in the pew. That in Christ there is no east or west, in him no north or south. In the words of St. Paul, we're no longer Jew and Greek, male and female, slave or free. We're all one in Jesus Christ. That dream motivated the leaders of that church at Trinity, the same dream that Dr. King had had. Becky and I were married in that church in 1972. And 31 years later, our son was married in that church. A church that risks, a church that dares to make a difference, a church that pays the price for living out dreams, will change people's lives. Becky was committed to that kind of church. It made me become a different kind of person. No longer was the height of Christian morality to be respectable and polite. It was to, and I've never been courageous enough to really confront evil, but at least I've been able to appreciate the people who are that brave. Dr. King had a dream, and he died trying to live out that dream. And because of his dream, our church was different and I became different. The Bible says that without a dream, the people will perish. I said the second greatest sin a church can commit is to be boring. Once in a while people, I've said that before, and once in a while people ask me, what's the greatest sin? And very simply, the greatest sin any church can commit is to be racist, sexist, elitist, to think that my group of people is better than your group of people. When my way of living, my way of thinking is seen as superior, closer to God than their way. That's the greatest sin a church can commit. That's why I'm here at Coronado. 1978, I was sent to a church back in Jacksonville. Nice people, fine people, really loving, caring people. But one Sunday, this young college student showed up in church. He was from Africa. He was a product of Methodist missions in Africa. And his parents had told him, when you go to college in the United States, go to the nearest Methodist church. And he made the mistake of doing that. He came to our church, sat down in a pew, and two of the ushers, who were also trustees of the church, walked over to me and said, shouldn't we tell him to leave? I said, no. And so they left. They would not come back to church until he figured out he wasn't welcome. Didn't take too many weeks. And we had an education building that was unused except for an hour on Sunday morning. It was in bad repair. Our church was in financial difficulties. And Head Start approached us. And Head Start said, we would like to rent your building 5 days a week. We will pay you big rent. We'll fix the building up, and you can still use it on Sundays. And the trustee said, that's a great deal. We can't do it. Why not? They said, well, half the kids in Head Start are black, and if people see black folks at our church during the week, they'll think they're welcome on Sunday. What really bothered me is that congregation never understood why this upset me. They never got it. They never understood that for me it was a matter of basic Christian belief and of basic morality. To them, it was just custom. As they said, birds of a feather like to flock together. To them, it was just people like to be with people like themselves. They never understood that this tore the heart out of the gospel. And that's why I'm here instead of there. We must constantly be on guard. It's so easy to, in this church, you know, racism is not appreciated. But that subtle unconscious racism that says, you know, we are closer to God than other people, that's an invidious thing. It can be in all of us. We have to constantly be in guard. I have a friend who's going to be leaving his church this year, and one of the great fears in that church is that his successor will be a woman. A woman? Can you imagine a woman being pastor? You know, men are closer to God than women. You know. God has created all human beings. Dr. King's dream was that one day people would be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin or the shape of their skin, whenever my tribe is better than your tribe, we crucify Christ again. Dr. King's dream ended up being my salvation. It made me a far different person than I was before. Still a Christian, but a different kind of Christian. Being polite is not the highest calling of a Christian. Taking risks so that all people can be seen as equal before God. That's a dream. And may we all share it. Pray with me. Oh God, forgive my lack of courage and my inherent preference for being quiet rather than doing something. Forgive me for watching while others take risks, and I simply applaud them. Guide our church to be willing to take risks so that whoever is different from us knows that they are valued and welcomed and that they're worth fighting for. Thank you for people like Dr. King who had a dream and were willing to die for it. May our young and old alike have dreams and visions of what your kingdom is like on earth as it is in heaven. Amen.